Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 128.
This week on the podcast, if Lena Dunham's book and my memory are any guide, mock slavery social experiments were how history got taught to a generation of New York City kids in the 90s.
And the newly appointed Ebola czar is not the czar John McCain would have picked if he was in favor of appointing czars, which he's not, so stop asking him about it.
The U.S. practices its favorite kind of armchair diplomacy, airdropping lethal aid on rebels with ambiguous goals.
And a political poll proves that it's easy to be panicked about everything when you know nothing about anything.
This week in Hillary Pillory, thought crime strikes again, this time care of Harper's.
And SCOTUS faces their biggest gender divide yet, and not even on gender issues.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com. And that's what you should do. We have an exciting story to begin this week's podcast with. We are both in the middle of reading Lena Dunham's new book.
Yeah.
As we would be, as we're those kind of people.
I might not.
Brent, no, Brent's a new convert.
I'm a new convert to her. I'm not a convert to girls.
No, he's never going to be a convert to girls.
I don't like the show. I don't like anybody on the show. I find them all reprehensible, and I don't like it. But I'm coming around to her as a person that I can like outside of whatever her character is on Girls.
Correct. And I last week reached a point in her book where she refers to an experience that she had with a program called Nature's Classroom when she was in like third or fourth grade. That is their Underground Railroad exercise.
Right. And first off, before you even know that Nature's Classroom is an Underground Railroad exercise, it sounds terrible.
Well, Nature's Classroom is this thing that New York City kids would be, like, carted off into nature to, like, learn about the world as trees and such.
No.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I never did Nature's Classroom. I think it was mostly a thing that kids at private schools got sent to. Mm-hmm. But Nature's Classroom is something that was, like, fairly common with people my age. Like, I know other people who did Nature's Classroom. And if you went to sort of a progressive-y private school, you would often, I guess they would opt into this exercise. And she says in the book that no one ever believes her when she talks about this, and I believe her because I'm about to talk about a couple similar experiences that I had,
which is just bonkers.
In her experience, Nature's Classroom did this thing where they like released a bunch of New York City kids into the forest and told them that they were going to be runaway slaves, and then these counselors were going to like come on horseback and like catch them and round them up. So she describes being like terrified behind, like hiding behind a tree with like a kid who's wheezing, and she's telling him to shut up because they're going to get caught. And like, it's just like this absolutely terrifying experience. So I read that and was like, oh my God, it happened to other people too.
Right.
Something similar actually.
You felt validated.
I felt validated. Something similar happened twice to me at two different schools, once in third grade and once in sixth grade. It was apparently the 90s was like an era where people thought it would be really fun to try social experiments on their classrooms in elementary schools.
My question is, was this part of at least in public schools, was this part of the curriculum, or did your teachers choose to do this as sort of like...
I'm pretty sure that my teachers chose to do this independently.
Right. But you had two separate teachers.
Thinking we'd all learn about them, learn a little bit about ourselves. So the first one happened at a private school. And then we're in third grade.
Oh, I didn't know you went to private school.
I went to private school for 2 years. Okay. It was a disaster. I was horribly bullied and eventually asked to leave because they couldn't control the bullies. So I was little. I was like very little. And I was new to the school in third grade. It was a school where people had like been their whole lives.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So I was like a new kid and I was super little. And I just got like mercilessly bullied.
Oh, no.
So keep that in mind as I tell you this story. Because I, as my mom recounted to me today, I basically went to school every day terrified.
Oh, God.
So we're in this third grade classroom and we get like ushered into the story area. And then suddenly the teacher just starts screaming at us out of the blue and starts threatening us with a broom handle. As if she's going to hit us with a broom handle. This is like a really progressive, like hippy-dippy school that's all like about unity and diversity. You know, it's one of the first private schools that was sort of like aimed to have a truly diverse student body. And it's like known for their scholarships and blah, blah, blah. We all are ushered into the story area, no warning, threatened with a broom. And then at some point, I seem to recall having been like shoved in a closet or something. Like, my mom remembers that I was complaining of being shoved into a closet, and I had sort of blocked that memory out, but then when she said it, it sounded really familiar, because I do remember spending time in a closet during my time there. So I think that might have been part of the same experiment.
In any case, a separate experiment, then that's the whole separate issue.
We all start, like, crying, well, because as duh. You would. And, you know, that sort of devolved into a catastrophe where it was just like a bunch of kids screaming and crying in the corner while someone threatened them with a broom. So that was the third grade version of that. Right. And then later, afterwards, we were told that that's what it was like to be a slave.
That's it. Was there any further learning at all, I mean, or anything?
We were on our, like, slavery unit or whatever. Yeah, sure. But any time that you try to convince a bunch of, like, fairly privileged kids in a private school that they're about to learn firsthand what slavery is like, you're just in for a disaster. It can't be done.
You can't do that. Yes.
In sixth grade, they tried again, though. Oh, and in boy. Sixth grade, it took on a slightly more disturbing timbre, if that's... I mean, my mom says that I was very disturbed by the third grade one, and I don't remember it as well because...
You were younger.
I was young.
Right.
In sixth grade, I remember it real well. And it had far-reaching consequences that reached outside of that classroom.
Oh, God.
Because in that version, there were a few kids that were appointed to be slave masters. Then they were to tie all of our hands and feet together with duct tape.
The kids had to do this?
Yes. And make us lie on desks in uncomfortable proximity to each other.
God.
And then just scream at us a lot. But it was kids that were doing it.
Oh, my God.
And not, I don't think, this was...
Had they been prepped for this at all prior to just being told to do it?
They
like,
were just
on the day?
They were, quote, arbitrarily chosen. It didn't escape anyone's notice that all of the kids that were chosen were African-American.
No.
And because of that, and it wasn't that all of the African-American kids got to be slave masters.
Right.
You know, some of them also ended up tied up with us in these desks. But because of that, it took on this really weird...
But none of the white kids got to be slave masters.
None of the white kids were slave masters.
Right.
And it took on this really weird timbre where suddenly it became, like, very racially charged.
Oh,
as you would imagine that kind of thing would. And it sort of broke down in a weird way because years later I had this epiphany. Because finally we were all getting screamed at so much, some kid pulled the Holocaust card because I know...
You mentioned that to me earlier today when you were sort of like prepping me that you were going to tell
the story.
And I was like, the Holocaust
Here's
card?
Here's the story. Every kid... So it became like a thing where like we had to learn this lesson because our ancestors perpetrated this crime.
Oh, sure.
Every white kid in that room was Jewish. Every
right.
single one of them.
Right.
So, like, finally someone was like, wait a minute.
Everyone's ancestors had crimes perpetrated against them in the room.
In the room.
Black, white, or otherwise.
Wait a minute. And, like, everyone was suddenly like, hold on. My ancestors did not perpetrate slavery. They were victims of the Holocaust.
I was going to say, they were not here.
Right. And then it got really sort of, like, desperate. Because then we had to learn a lesson anyway. You know, like, it's hard for kids to kind of understand what they're talking about. Years later, I had an epiphany. Which really bothered me, even though this is totally unfair of me to be bothered by this. But, so, this was a school that was fairly racially segregated. It was very small, but, like, you know, the African-American kids hung out together, the Hispanic kids hung out together, and the white kids hung out together. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that as much as they tried to create a diverse student body, we all lived in fairly segregated neighborhoods, so, like,
sure.
you would hang out with the kids that lived near you.
Yeah.
And then those kids lived on the Upper West Side, like you did, and then, you know, whatever.
Sure.
And... So that was part of the reason that it broke down racially so dramatically. But the Hispanic kids kind of took on the mission of the African American kids.
Oh,
and years later, I had this epiphany where I realized that the only kids in that room whose ancestors would have been slave owners were the Hispanic kids.
Uh-oh.
Because not in America probably.
Right.
But
sure.
that was because they were white. They were all white. You know?
Sure.
So I finally, years later, was like, not only was this just unfair because Jewish kids are raised with like a really like intense sort of like, you know, connection to history because this crime was so recent, because the Holocaust was so recent.
Sure.
Those kids were really like sort of steeped in Holocaust lore to the point that they felt like they came out of like a real tragic tradition.
Yeah.
So like to sort of already turn
Add
slavery on them
on top,
was
right,
like
exactly,
more
sure.
than people could take.
Right.
But then on top of that, to have the only kids whose ancestors could have been legitimately blamed for this crime get away free and clear, and not only that, get to blame these Jewish kids for having caused slavery was just like...
But they weren't actually...
No one was actually
right, exactly. That's the
responsible
thing. Right.
is the point.
Right.
But once you're having the conversation, to have
right.
the conversation be so skewed... And that was what I think
I think the point of the story is... don't have this conversation.
Don't have this conversation this way. I
mean, have the slavery conversation, no, sure.
Talk about slavery, sure.
You should be doing that in school.
Absolutely. But. No, it was. It's not a good way to have a conversation. And it's, no. It's derived from these experiments where, like, you know, my mom was talking about how years ago there was sort of like this teacher who did this experiment where she, like, divided kids into blue-eyed and brown-eyed kids. Oh, and, sure. Like, they told one of them that they were slaves and one that they were masters, yeah. And did nothing in the class, like, devolved into chaos.
Right.
And that's sort of what happened here, but with the addition of duct tape and being tied to your desk.
Don't do that. I can't believe that was, like...
I can't believe either. I actually, the second time around, asked to leave the room. I was like, this has already happened to me once.
Right.
I know where this is going. It's nowhere good. And I was like, so, because that was another school where I had terrible bullies.
Oh, yeah.
So like I was already, and that was the other thing, is the girl that she chose to be like the lead slave master was like the most notorious bully in the school.
God. So she was doing it already anyway.
It got out of hand really fast.
Oh, good.
But in any way, what, first of all, this is not an accurate comparison to slavery. Well, being tied to your desk is not the same thing as being the middle passage.
I think that's the whole point, is that you can't, because not only can you not represent what
slavery was like,
by attempting to do so,
you've actually sort of damaged the conversation.
You do, and it makes slavery seem trite, which it was not.
It creates winners and losers in a conversation where we're just supposed... We should only be sympathizing with slaves. There shouldn't be anyone in the room who can sympathize with slave owners or can sympathize with sort of like, you know, who can sort of get... Who has the impression that some people, like, deserve to be treated poorly.
Right.
And everyone in that room thought that whoever was on the other side deserved to be treated poorly.
Right.
We were all sitting there like, you know, this girl who was like this horrible bully. We were all like, well... I mean, if anyone should be the slave in this experiment, it should be her because she's so mean.
Right.
And, like, then she was sitting there like, well, you're white, so you deserve to know what this is like because your ancestors didn't know.
Yeah.
And then there was, like, a long conversation about, you know, whose ancestors were slaves that were white. It became, like, a totally irrelevant conversation.
Sure.
And it ended up carrying on outside of the classroom because suddenly everyone in the hallways was angry about their ancestors being doing X, Y, and Z. The conversation continued for weeks.
Oh,
and it was, like, so destructive and horrible and such a disturbing experience. I don't know if you've ever been an awkward middle schooler. The last thing you want as an awkward middle schooler who, like, doesn't really fit in their clothes right and is, like, sort of just, like, uncomfortable and doesn't really want to be, like, touching boys but does and, like, all of these things is to have your hands and feet tied together and be forced to lie uncomfortably on a desk that's too short for your hands and feet along with all of your classmates. That's the last thing you want.
That's not it.
It's not what you want. It's not what you want at all. Because then also... Then there's the people that get teased for screaming. Then there's the people that get teased for crying. It can't go anywhere good. In any case, this was like a thing that was happening in the 90s. That was like some teaching method. And I hadn't heard of it happening since. Except that I went on Nature's Classroom's website today and found that this is still a part of their program.
That's insane.
Nature's Classroom, I would urge you to stop this.
I can't believe
it's important for everyone to learn about the horrors of slavery.
Yes.
It is not important for everyone to be traumatized by an experience that they can't quite directly connect to slavery.
Right, exactly.
And it's just like a terrible thing that happened to them. And releasing a bunch of New York City kids into a forest and telling them to run for their lives is about the meanest thing that you can do to them.
Right.
My mom was like, release them on a city street. They'll be fine. They'll get away. But, like, I can't think of anything that would have scared me more.
I know. It's just so ridiculous.
So ridiculous. I once had to do...
Well, kids, the lesson's over. Now you know what slavery was like.
I once had to do a treasure hunt on one of those forest retreat things that they bring New York City kids to, and it was terrifying. It was a treasure hunt. It was like a...
It was supposed to be fun.
It was supposed to be fun. It was not fun. It was terrifying. I had to go into the forest by myself. I didn't like that. In any case... So I wanted to just share that anecdote because no one ever believes that happened to me twice.
Oh.
And Lena Dunham is also apparently having similar issues convincing people that this has happened, but at least she's validated my experience.
And if you're listening, we tweeted at you today.
We tweeted at you today.
Lena Dunham.
Right, so keep an eye out.
Yeah.
In any case, Ebola.
Yeah.
That's where it's...
That's our segue.
That's where it's at. It's happening. It's happening here. We have, you know, we've talked about these two nurses that have Ebola. And the one that flew to Cleveland and back with Ebola.
Last week was, like, a terrible disaster because we found out that she had been on, like... She found out that she had been on two planes and, like, some kids from some, like, Ohio public schools had, like, been on the same plane. So, like, the schools shut down and, like, it was a real
like, half the Midwest shut down because they were worried that the outbreak monkey had come and given them Ebola.
Yeah, exactly. So, it was just, like... the Ebola discussion last week just really devolved into, like, a just a ridiculous place where, like, everybody was, like, just full on panic. Like, the country was just panicked about.
They released the names of the nurses who had contracted Ebola. The first nurse was Nina Pham, and she's supposedly in good condition.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know how to be optimistic about Ebola because you don't know what's going to happen with Ebola.
She died at any moment.
But she seemed, they're optimistic about her. And then Amber Joy Vinson is the nurse that was on all these planes visiting the Midwest.
Yeah.
The nurses union at that Dallas hospital is pissed.
Right.
Because it turned out that they really weren't following the right protocol when Thomas Eric Duncan or whatever his name is came in.
And there's been a lot of discussions too about what the right protocol is.
Right.
Anyway, because, like, I think they're revising what the protocol is.
Well,
to begin with.
Yeah.
So whether they were following it right or not, it's different from when they were following it or not following
it. But their precautions increased dramatically the longer he was there. But those nurses that treated him initially were treating him with exposed skin.
Right.
They weren't properly disposing of the gowns that they were using to treat him. They were drawing blood and taking mucus samples and doing all these things without proper cover. And so that is how they think that they contracted Ebola.
Yeah.
And now, and Amber Joy Vinson is not being treated at that hospital because the nurses basically...
No, I think they took her to a...
They took her to another hospital. Well, the nurses at the Dallas hospital refused to treat her.
Oh, boy.
And not because they didn't want her to survive, but because they were like, we don't have the safety protocols in effect here.
Well,
we don't want to all get Ebola.
There were a lot of stories about, like, just how that hospital itself sort of, like, was in kind of some shambles,
They were in a lot of hot water and possibly because the hospital itself is a mess.
Right.
And not surprisingly, considering they tried to send an Ebola patient home first.
Right, exactly.
It's not surprising to hear that
they started off on the wrong foot here.
Right, and that they were not doing well.
Right.
In any case, there's been some CDC monitoring of a bunch of people that came in contact with all of these Ebola victims.
They were either at the hospital or were on the planes or whatever.
And so 43 of them have been cleared, including Thomas Eric Duncan's fiance and their 13-year-old son, Timothy, and some people that they were sharing an apartment with. So the sort of initial first round people have been cleared. There's still 120 people being monitored.
But that a lot of those people are going to come off, supposedly,
soon. In the next few days. Either today or tomorrow. And those are people that were, like, sitting near Amber Joy Vinson on her flights or, you know, in her family or stuff like that.
But there's, like, you know, some of them are kids that are going to go back to school. And so they're, like, you know.
They're having to urge the community to reaccept them.
Like, that's
not good. That's not a good thing.
These kids didn't do anything.
No.
Other than just be somewhere where someone who had Ebola might have been. I mean.
Well, and the sort of main, you know, part of it, I think because they mismanaged this so badly in Dallas, everyone is, like, really panicked about, like, you know, how easily it can seem to spread.
I think
part of it is people don't really trust that the CDC is taking the right steps because this has gotten bungled.
Well, and also people in Texas are stupid, so there's
And they're
that.
Stupid. It's a
so
problem.
So that's, you know, when you think that someone can just come back to school and then maybe, like, you know, just happen to give them Ebola because they're sitting there, then that's, you know, that's where the problem lies.
That's basically where the problem lies. Yeah. No, so it's been a bit of a disaster, especially a PR disaster.
Yeah.
And because there's been such a PR disaster, they finally appointed an Ebola czar.
Right. Well, John McCain got his wish. We talked to you last week that Mr. Czar hater himself, John McCain, was really
dying
pressing the administration for one.
So they appointed Ron Klain.
Right. They didn't get the one they wanted.
No. As we knew they wouldn't, because they don't get anything they want because they don't want the things that they get.
Right, exactly.
It's a sort of reverse situation where what they get is not what they want because they got it.
And the Ebola czar doesn't have to go through confirmation, so Obama can make it whoever he wants. Right.
So he made it this guy who used to be the chief of staff for Gore and Biden when they were VP.
He ran Gore's Florida recount situation.
Which is not a good sign. And he was also, his current position is the CEO of the Founders Holding Company for AOL, so I don't know if I trust him.
Yeah, who knows?
But he's sort of like a political insider.
He is.
And he's going to be working under Lisa Monaco, who'd been sort of overseeing this for Homeland Security.
Yeah. We still don't have a Surgeon General, though.
No, so that's just not... That's not going to be a part of the equation because we don't have one. It's a mess.
Yeah.
But obviously Republicans are not happy because they wanted, apparently what they didn't specify earlier is that they wanted Obama to appoint a doctor.
Right.
They only knew that after he didn't appoint a doctor, though. Right. So that was part of the problem.
Yeah.
So they want, apparently, you know, he's kind of a political guy.
Right.
And obviously the Obama administration views this primarily as a political challenge because it primarily is.
It is.
But so now the Republicans have decided that him not being a doctor is a deal breaker.
Yeah,
now, as Salon pointed out, a czar in this sort of circumstance isn't really responsible for, like, administering care. They're just someone who's got to coordinate between various government bodies and, you know, foreign governments and Congress and whatever. And so the qualifications for a czar job don't really have to be a medical degree.
No.
It's more important that he have good political relationships than anything else. So they, at least at Ceylon, where decisions are apparently made, they don't seem to be that concerned about his lack of medical qualifications. And also, we have doctors working on this. We know
that's the thing.
There are people who are, like, looking out for the medical sort of, you know, needs that this situation has. It doesn't need to be the czar, because the czar is responsible for making sure those people are in touch with the right people.
Well,
not
and that's
coming
what
a, up with the protocol.
Well, and that's what a chief of staff
does.
Would know how to do.
Exactly.
Be the chief of staff.
Of staffing. Yes.
Right.
The chief who staffs things. Yeah, that's he's a guy who coordinates.
Right.
He's a coordinator, if you will. In any case, obviously they were never going to be happy with that.
Something that doctors may not be good at.
Well, I think that's part of the problem is that someone with medical expertise doesn't necessarily know who needs the expertise the most, because they're not aware of the political realities of the situation.
Right.
They might know all the things you need to know, but that doesn't mean they know who to tell them to.
Right.
You know, it's how it works.
Oh,
in any case, back to the Middle East, where we're now aiding rebels. Arming rebels.
Yes.
And aiding rebels.
We are.
We're doing all of those things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On Sunday, the U.S. being we, not me, not me and Brent, announced that we had airdropped some weapons and medical supplies and ammunition.
Some lethal aid.
Some lethal aid, as we called it, on a bunch of rebels who are fighting on the Turkish border. These are Kurdish
rebels.
That's
in where Kobani is, which is sort of like a new kind of like hotspot for where all this fighting is happening.
Yeah, and that's
right
when
now.
if Kobani falls, then we've got a whole sort of regional issue, because then
right.
that whole area, and that's the next biggest city that's sort of in peril. So,
right.
And also Turkey finally stepped in.
Ugh, finally. That's what everybody has been
only days too late.
Exactly. I know.
And so they're also helping the Kurdish rebels kind of make passage. Across the border and stuff, so that they can continue to defend Kobani and the rest of that.
They're still
region.
Not really sort of getting involved as much as everyone would hope militarily.
But here's the secret. That's not a secret. They don't like the Kurds. They're not trying to care about the Kurds. They're doing this because of international pressure, probably.
No, but I think what
I know that their sort of own land is in peril in this situation.
That's what I think so many countries in the region are just
but I think,
not recognizing.
I think that Turkey doesn't really consider that to be their concern, because the Kurds are sort of semi-autonomous, and I think that Turkey is probably just like, fuck you guys, because they're not trying to be involved. Now, I don't think that's necessarily a smart strategy.
No, because
on their part.
Right. The
But,
you know, the
it's
longer,
certainly a complicated situation for them.
The longer they are not involved, you know, the more likelihood that there is that they are going to have to directly deal with the ISIS problem
instead of
sort of, you know, helping out now when they could sort of probably
I think that they were trying to sort of wait on the U.S. and see if we could solve problems.
Well,
that's what everyone seems to be trying to do.
I know.
Guys.
Come on.
Leave us alone.
It's not our problem.
It's not our problem.
It's only our problem because you fuckers are too lazy to get involved.
Well, and because we destabilized the entire region. But beyond that,
right?
It's not our problem.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
No, I mean, it's the kind of problem where at a certain point we have to sort of be like, okay, we destabilized everything and we're sorry. But like, we can't just be fighting. Like,
I know.
At this point, we don't know
who
the right
person
to lead
is. Sort of is suspect of our leadership on this whole thing.
Well,
because
we are the wrong people to offer leadership.
Right.
Here's the problem, though. Literally every person is the wrong person to offer leadership on this situation. There's not anyone who's the right person.
No.
Everything is a mess. We couldn't be more wrong, because we've already proven that we can bungle things and not fix them.
Yeah, exactly.
But
like, who do you want to fix? Do you want Iran to fix it?
Well,
the Iraqi government to fix it? We know that they can't. You want Assad to fix it? Like, none of these people can fix
it. Leaving Saddam Hussein there was enabling us to do was not fix anything, because he was just harassing everyone, and we were sort of out of it. It's sort of like the problem with overthrowing the dictator that you put there to stabilize things is that then you're back to square one in terms of stabilizing things, which is where we are currently.
The old power vacuum.
Vacuum that we love to talk about, which is still there.
Yeah.
Just heading away. Just
there's less of a power vacuum now because
someone's coming
into
power. Well, you can't always control who fills the vacuum, and
ISIS.
That's the problem.
Right. Yeah,
bingo. You know? It's better to have a benevolent mean person than a mean person.
Right.
I guess. I don't know. Maybe. I just can't. We can't know. We don't live there. We're not from there. We don't really understand the political realities that effectively.
No.
So, like, we don't know. We're the absolute wrong people. Because who are we to go around being like, electoral democracy for you. It'll work for you. It worked for us. Like, it worked for us because we came out of a history of, you know, like, we were, our government was formed by British people. They had already lived in a democracy. They knew how to form a democracy because that was part of their political tradition.
Yeah.
That's not to say that that works the same way for everyone. I'm as much in favor of democracy as the next American, because that is sort of like the, and I don't want to use the word propaganda in the negative sense, but like that is the tradition that we're raised in and raised to sort of think is valuable. And I think it's valuable because I'm an American who was sort of socialized in that, you know, world. But I don't know what to fucking do about these. If we can't form a democracy over there, let them form whatever the fuck they're going to form. Because we obviously don't know.
Yeah, it was working for
a while. It was working for a while. Not great, but better.
Better than this.
Better than this.
Yeah.
And it was cheaper for us on top of everything.
Big time.
In any case, we're not the only people who are frustrated by this situation.
Between Ebola and ISIS, everyone is just panic-stricken.
Panic. Yes. Yeah. Politico did this poll this week. That they did in, like, the sort of most contentious congressional districts.
Yeah.
Where they found that everyone is just panicked about everything. Everyone feels like the U.S. is out of control. We've lost control of all of our major challenges.
Right.
And only 36% of respondents said that the country is, quote, in a good position to meet its economic and national security hurdles.
Yeah, boy.
Here are the reasons why.
Right.
First of all, everyone seems convinced that ISIS is a direct personal threat to us, which is not true.
Well, here's the thing that I think with all of these poll numbers that we're going to get to, is that there is... The hysteria is sort of breeding more hysteria, and it's not it's not hysteria that is based on any sort of actual fact.
No.
Because this very first thing that, like you just said, 84% of voters say ISIS poses a serious threat to the U.S. homeland. It is not even trying to pose a threat to the U.S. homeland.
If there's one place it doesn't pose a threat, it's to the homeland. It poses a threat to other people's homelands and to a lot of land.
Yes.
But not our homeland. It's
not their end game.
No. They don't care about us. It's the foreign land that the threat is posed to. And certainly that will destabilize a political region that we, you know, have worked hard to stabilize. And there are reasons that we are involved.
There are threats that could come out of that to us. Sure. Like, obviously, if we don't get it under control. But ISIS is not trying to, like, they're not trying to fly airplanes into the World
Trade Center. They are trying to take over the Middle East.
Right.
They have a sort of a plan that has nothing to do with our land.
Right.
So even the phrasing of that question, though, is a little annoying to me, because I'm sort of like, if you're asked, are they a threat to the homeland, like, how are you to say, like, is there a way to think that they're a threat but not to the land home, to the land of our home, but to just land in general?
Yeah.
So that's problematic. Also, a surprising number of people seem convinced that their healthcare costs are about to go up, which is funny because they're about to go down, unless you didn't have healthcare, in which case now you have healthcare, so good for you.
Right, but you're having to pay for it.
You're having to pay for it, I guess. But and we're going to talk a little bit about, because Paul Krugman wrote this long defense of Obama this week in Rolling Stone, and part of what he talks about is sort of like the imperfect but better system that is Obamacare.
Yeah.
And part of that is people having to pay for healthcare instead of it just sort of like existing for everyone.
Yeah.
But It's not true that everyone's healthcare costs are going up. It's just true that people seem convinced that they're going
up. Right, correct.
Is sort of the problem.
Yeah.
And what were these people spending on healthcare before? Because
I don't know.
The premium costs have gone down pretty significantly if you had any sort of healthcare.
Yeah.
If you had a plan that didn't cover anything, then I assume that your costs have gone up. But like also don't have that plan.
No.
That doesn't help anyone. That's just giving away money.
Yeah.
Another surprising question that got included in this poll, which is the most annoying question.
Yeah.
Which had to do with whether people thought that Obama or Bush would be more effective at managing the federal government.
Yeah.
And 38% said Bush and 35% said Obama.
Yeah.
And then a quarter of them said that the two men were equally competent. Do we remember
when
George Bush left office and we couldn't trust him with anything?
I know. Well, this is the thing.
This is a man who's painting for a living now.
I thought that George Bush would maybe sort of like end the trend of everyone remembering presidents more fondly after they left office.
Yes.
Because we
do that a lot.
We do that a lot.
Clinton. Yes. Clinton dismantled the welfare system, but don't we love a good Clinton?
Yes.
You know?
He's the hero
of the Democratic Party. Right, he's the Reagan of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. So I really thought that George Bush was going to buck the trend and really be the one president that would go on being hated until the end of time.
He was that bad.
He was that bad.
Yeah.
But man.
Wrong.
How quickly we forget.
Wrong.
We're like goldfish.
We're like Americans. Goldfish. We're just like goldfish. Yeah, we apparently fondly remember the days of having a president that we couldn't trust with pretzel eating in front of the television.
We couldn't even trust him with the English language, let alone running a country.
No, it's... Well, the man hadn't traveled anywhere right. except Mexico before he took the presidency. He did speak Spanish roughly as well as he spoke English, which I thought, hey, at least this is a guy who can almost speak Spanish.
He's trying. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He can also only almost speak English, so that was a problem for me personally, and I think millions of other people. But this is a...
Come on, guys.
Don't look back on Bush's presidency and think to yourself, oh, those were the days.
Don't do that.
Those were the days of 9/11 and war. Right.
Even if you are a Republican, don't do that.
Don't
think of a different Republican president. Don't you remember
when the Republicans couldn't do that? Don't you remember when John McCain and Mitt Romney couldn't be seen with George Bush because he was too much of a liability?
Remember those days.
Remember those days. Those were the days.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Meanwhile, also, no one thinks that Ebola is being handled effectively.
No. Well,
least of all me, because I've been panicked about Ebola since before there was Ebola.
I know. Yeah.
I mean, I am one of the few, like, wackadoo liberals who I think is just in a total state of panic, Fox News style, about Ebola.
I know.
Only because I've always been in that state.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, Shep Smith was, like, the one who was doing all the sense talking about Ebola.
I know.
This
he
week.
Was like, guys, you're not going to get Ebola. Calm the fuck down.
Yeah. He
Meanwhile,
did like a whole segment about it.
And I was like the person who normally, and this was my normal response to Shep Smith, which is to be like, shut up,
shut
you're
up.
Wrong. But intellectually, I know I'm panicking for no reason. It's just that, I have this sort of visceral reaction.
Yeah.
The sort of, the truthiness facts have a lot to do with me getting Ebola.
Yeah.
It's a very concerning trend.
But the poll numbers were that only 20% of respondents said that they had a lot of confidence that the government was going to do it, that was able to contain it.
Yeah.
And 38% had some confidence. And this was before we found out that the second person had it, by the way.
Yeah.
So it's probably gone down since then, if I had to guess.
No, I would imagine that we're all pretty panicked at this point.
Yeah, this was before October 11th, and last week was the week that everybody went real balls out crazy.
It was one of those things where we were like, oh my God, someone got Ebola. I guess we don't know what we're doing. And then another person did, and we were like, holy shit.
Yeah.
And then it turned out she'd been flying, and we were like, what is going on?
Yeah.
And then it was like, suddenly 150 people are being monitored for Ebola, and it's like, we all just have to panic without any sort of facts or, figures to support us. It was a mess.
So, everyone, we get that there are some tough issues going on in the country right now, but pull yourselves together.
And here's what you shouldn't do: get all up in Hillary Clinton's grill about being awesome.
She's not gonna fix it. She's not your answer.
But there's been some thought crime going on this week as well, because Harper's had like a sort of epic Hillary takedown.
They did
this week.
Yeah.
Doug Henwood, who writes for them, wrote
coming up on the 2-year anniversary of our epic Hillary takedown.
And on Huffington Post, it was titled the exact same thing as our takedown of Hillary was titled on their like front page.
Oh yeah, it was.
And I was like, you assholes,
because we sent that to them.
Where is our credit, Huffington Post?
Yeah.
We've been talking about this for fucking years.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
Maybe we should, again, repost. Once in a while, we have to repost this
thing. We repost it every once in a while. Maybe we should resend it to them, too.
Let's tweak it and send it to them. Let's do everything.
Yeah.
Because it turns out that people are trying to thought crime us left, right, and center.
All over the place.
Once a year, at least, someone thought crimes us on this one in particular. God. But this isn't the only thing. In any case, the sort of major points that he makes are points that we have echoed in the past.
Yes.
One is that she didn't really do much as a senator.
No,
she was a junior senator from New York. She was talking a big game because there was a lot of, pressure on her because
she made friends with John McCain and Lindsey Graham, and
she
voted for war. She was
around with John McCain. She was voting for wars. She was sort of working on these little symbolic measures.
Right.
But most of those were things that didn't require her
and
support.
And she sort of gets some credit for the 9/11 health bill, but it's like,
right, well,
she
gets some credit for a bill that extended unemployment benefits
to
responders.
That's what it was. Right.
She did not pass
the 9/11
health bill.
She
worked on it.
Yeah.
She didn't get it passed.
Yeah.
Kirsten Gillibrand got it passed.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kirsten Gillibrand.
Yeah.
You're a person who's
effective. With a little help from Chuck Schumer at the end.
A junior senator, but she's just like Hillary Clinton, she was a junior senator. She had a lot fewer sort of angles to work because she was not a Clinton.
Right.
So she hadn't been the president, basically.
Yeah.
But so she got it passed. What Hillary Clinton got passed is a bill that extended, and it was an important bill, but she also required a lot of help from Chuck Schumer and on that bill. And that is small potatoes compared to sort of what the expectations were of her going in, because she was supposed to have all this built up political know-how and will and whatever.
Yeah.
Also, she's a fucking hawk.
She's a hawk.
And that's
this is what my, we, has always been my biggest has, problem.
That's always been what we've been reminding people of. Hillary Clinton is not someone who's going to solve our foreign policy issues because she loves to go to war.
She loves to go to war.
She's a war lover.
She
got us into
the Iraq War. She, and I forgot about this too, but she also was one of the Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda linkers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
She's not, she was not working with facts at that time, and she didn't care.
Yeah.
She's sort of overly ambitious, which is fine. It's great for a woman to be ambitious. I'm for it. Sure. But she's been sort of prepping for this. She is one of the people who thinks it's her turn.
Yes.
Is the sort of issue that I have.
Yeah, with and there was a supposed slogan that I think that she that she someone coined. Claims that she you're right, she quit 8 years of Bill, 8 years of Hill.
Yeah.
So I mean this was and that was like after they that was after they got married or something.
Yeah,
like,
no, it was very this is like not a recent when they graduated from law school or something like that. Yeah. This is not this has always been her ambition.
Yeah.
And I don't think that you get to think of the presidency as your like birthright that way. You know, you don't get to decide
that. I don't think that you get to think of it as your birthright. On some level I think that you sort of have to think as, like that
to even want to be president,
to be president but anyway.
Mitt because, Romney like, thought just, it was his birthright.
Well, right. Because you don't just sort of like wake up one day and sort of just like decide that you're going to be president. No, you know what this, I mean? Like,
there's something about this that's very much not in the spirit of American democracy.
No, I
because
get
it. Because it sort of creates a dynasty.
Right.
And she was sort of intentionally creating a dynasty.
Right. It sort of
and,
goes in the face of anyone can be president. Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly. Like, it's, yeah. It's, yeah. And also, she, you know, had written her college thesis on Saul Alinsky, who was a community organizer, and his tactics, and then later kind of went back on what she had, you know, on her support for them, and kind of claimed that, you know, that welfare programs weren't effective, which is something that Bill Clinton then followed through on.
Right.
And she was offered a job with Saul Alinsky after graduating and went to law school instead. And he apparently said that going to law, you know, if she goes to law school, she won't change the world. And she was like, that's wrong. And she has changed the world, but I don't know if she's changed it in the ways that someone like Saul Alinsky would believe were good, were positive change.
Yeah.
Because basically, her domestic policy is not as liberal as people like to claim.
No, it's not.
It is actually quite conservative.
Right.
On issues that, you know, she speaks well on women's issues because she is a woman and she has sort of faced a lot of these issues personally.
Yeah.
She doesn't sort of offer the same kind of sort of hope and, you know, idea mongering, for lack of a better term, to people facing other types of discrimination.
Yep.
You know, she's not good on racial issues because she's not good on welfare issues.
Right.
She's not good on a lot of other things that have to do with the social safety net.
Well, and that's because one thing that she is good at is representing the rich.
Yes. She's in bed with Wall Street, 100%.
That was the other main point
for
this article.
And this is part of what has made the Clintons sort of so powerful to begin with is that they have all of these
Wall Street and bank allies.
They have rich friends. They have allies on Wall Street. But because of that, she's a corporatist. And so she's not really out for the little guy. She's out to protect corporations as much as your next Republican. So, and that's something that we've always said about her as well. You know, she's not someone that you can trust to sort of at least speak to the concerns of regular Americans because she doesn't share your concerns. And then on top of that, the concerns that she's out to represent aren't your concerns. They're the concerns of your enemies.
Right.
So, bingo. In any case, blah. Don't elect Hillary Clinton to be president.
Don't do it. That's it.
Transition.
Yes.
We're moving on.
No, right?
We're moving on to Catholics.
Enter segue here.
Yeah. Catholics.
Catholicism.
Yes.
So
the age-old religion.
You may have... There was a lot of hoopla last week surrounding this... All the Catholic bishops were meeting last week. I think for like 2 weeks
or something
like that.
Yeah, they had some sort of summit.
They had a summit, yes.
What do they call it? They call it something funny.
I don't know. It was called by Pope Francis. Yeah, yeah, it's definitely called something ridiculous, as you would expect. Anyway, so there was like an interim... They were deciding...
Synod or synod or something.
Yeah. They were deciding on some like important issues, just like, you know, some social issues, some just very sort of like...
Right, they're trying to evolve, or at least Pope Francis is trying to get them to evolve.
So there was... This report, like an interim report that they issued on Monday that like everybody was like blowing out about, like all the gays were posting it on my Facebook wall. And then also like they were, you know, it was on the front page of Huffington Post, basically like, you know, Pope Francis, like they're all the Catholics are coming around on the gays, basically.
Right.
Like it was real sort of like, it was pretty far out there. I mean, it was fairly, it was pretty optimistic.
It seemed like they were going to be saying something that was the opposite of condemming gays, which is a new thing for them.
Exactly. So what you may have not heard is the follow-up on that story is that none of those things made it
No, into the final document. And then the final document, which was totally watered down, couldn't even get the two-thirds majority right, exactly. that it needed to pass. Right.
And so after the report came out on Monday, like you said, it got watered down. And then even the watered down thing couldn't come to like a full resolution, like with all of the bishops that were there.
So Francis decides to release the report anyway, because he's just like, screw you guys, I guess. And they're planning to have a second meeting in October where they'll continue to talk about how much they can't agree on whether they like gays or not.
Yeah.
But, and this was not the, you know, the other issue that they were going to talk about was what to do about divorced people.
Yes.
A lot of Catholics are divorced.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
It's not an uncommon thing to find.
They can't take communion.
They can't take communion. And so they were thinking, oh, maybe we'll let the divorced people take communion. Maybe we won't hate gays so much. I don't know. Yeah. And then they decided not to do any of those things and to continue to hate everyone.
Right.
As they did before and be extremely judgmental.
But it really was sort of like, you know, I think people are still sort of loving the Pope because they think they saw him as the person who sort of like
did this. He seems to be spearheading sort of movement.
And he also chose to release the entirety of this report, like before it was even decided upon, like that was his decision. So it was like, it was through him that we sort of even figured out that this was the initial language and that it was a discussion. Otherwise,
although they sort of set themselves up for failure by having an interim report released before the end of the meeting, which was way more optimistic than what, and you know,
but I guess
it was just like a huge disappointment once again. And if they had not released the interim report, we might have felt like it was positive that they were even talking about gays in the first place.
Right.
But now everyone's going to be pissed.
Yeah. Somebody who is talking about gays is Anthony Kohler, who is a Republican House candidate in South Carolina. And he's
got some interesting thoughts.
Yeah. He urged voters not to support the Democratic representative, who's James Clyburn, who I'm sure is probably going to win because he's been in the House for a thousand zillion years. And his gremlin allies.
Gays are
gremlins, yes. Because he said on Facebook, he wrote that same-sex marriage is a pestilence that has descended on our society against our will by those in the courts and government that do not value the traditional family.
Ooh.
Oh, boy.
Right. And then goes on to compare same-sex couples to gremlins.
Yeah. He compared them to Gizmo.
He said they are deceptively and dangerously cute.
Yes. Well, that's true. That is my experience with gays,
of course. Same-sex couples that seek to destroy our way of life and the institution of marriage are not cute and cuddly, but rather gremlins that will destroy our way of life.
Oh, God. Mm. I loved that movie, by the way, when I was a kid. I bet you didn't.
No, too scary. Terrifying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They look all cute and cuddly until they turn out to be evil.
Oh, boy. Anyway.
Just like the gays, apparently.
What? Yeah.
According to one wingnut in South Carolina.
Yikes.
Then he adds, my favorite thing about this whole story is that at the very end of his Facebook message, he adds, do not attend the, quote, over-the-top and, quote, anything-goes ceremonies or parties that these people revel in.
I mean, come on.
The chaos.
Yes, like a real bacchanal.
I know. It's the only word you can really come up with to describe what he's thinking gays are all up to.
God, if only.
Yeah, if only.
Right?
I mean, I assume gays have better parties than this guy gets invited to.
I mean, obviously.
They must.
Yeah.
But he's a real person who exists, so know that.
Yeah. So we referenced this a little bit earlier, but there was a Paul Krugman wrote an article that was in Rolling Stone that was basically, I think it was actually even entitled, In Defense of Obama.
Yes.
Basically, you know, because, and I think everybody should be forced to read this.
Yeah.
Because
Obama's getting it from all sides.
He's getting it from all sides. And while I sort of even take issue with some of the things that Krugman says, like, you know, I do think that, like, his approval rating is, like, in the, like, high, it's in the 30s, I think, now, right? Or something, or low 40s or something like that. So, obviously, like, there's at least, like, 12 or 13%, you know, of Democrats who are sort of, like, just fed up with him.
Yeah.
And, like, especially going into, like, midterms right now, like, I think it's, we sort of have to, like, at least pretend to be excited.
Right.
And not even wanting to be seen with the president is sort of, like, not the right answer at this point. I mean, so, you know, it's...
He tries to point out some of the successes that the Obama... Because, you know, and I have this conversation a lot with my mother, because my mother obviously hates Obama for reasons that the far left hates him.
Sure.
And I always say to her, because our big argument always is, she's always like, he's a major disappointment, and I'm always like, yep.
Yes.
That's true.
Yes.
He was always going to be a disappointment. I didn't expect him to not be a disappointment. He's a Clintonian Democrat.
Sure.
He's a Republican. That's something I knew going in. I voted for him knowing that. So when he didn't turn out to be a hero to the left, I wasn't shocked.
Right.
And that's sort of where Krugman comes from.
Right.
He sort of points, because I say to my mom, always like, who finally got some healthcare reform passed?
Right.
Like, that is a huge That is a huge victory. Yeah. Like, there are things that Obama has done that I think historically will be considered major victories, given right. that no one has been able to address them in the last 30 years.
That's what I was going to say. Well, Krugman goes as far as to say that he's potentially one of the most, like, successful, just in terms of, like, actually doing
things. American history.
Ever.
Yeah. You know, and he talks about his healthcare reform, he talks about financial reform, he talks about, you know, the management of the economy, and then environmental policy. And these are all areas where I think a lot of people on the left felt like we got shafted because, you know, on healthcare reform, we got the Heritage Foundation system.
Right.
You know, on financial regulation, we got Dodd-Frank, which doesn't have much in the way of teeth.
Right.
But on the economy, we've gotten some very sort of milquetoast reforms that haven't really addressed the fact that our economy's been in the shitter for years.
Yeah.
And, you know, we haven't had really like aggressive stimulus the way that we'd wanted to because we can't pass anything.
Right.
And you know, and on the environment, we haven't gotten any sort of like sweeping changes.
Right.
So that's why the left is disappointed, the right is disappointed because he exists.
Right.
The middle ground is disappointed because there's so much tension in Congress that it doesn't seem like anything is passing.
Right.
But I feel like the things that Krugman does point out are things that I think we can remember have been successes.
Yes.
Healthcare reform is a big one. And he says, you know, this isn't the system that we would have all dreamed of. Like, he acknowledges that that's the case.
Yeah.
But he says this is a system that is better than the previous system, and that is the first time that that's happened in years.
Yeah.
You know, the Clintons tried to pass a healthcare reform that was similar, couldn't do it. Yeah. Hillary Clinton was in charge of that effort, and one of the things I've held against her for her entire career is that she didn't get that passed, because she compromised it away.
Yeah.
Now, we didn't get a public option in this. You know, there were all of these things that we didn't get in this healthcare reform package, but what we did get has made massive improvements to the system.
Yeah.
Just, and I always say, you know, the idea that there's a mandate is already a huge just change in thinking.
Yeah.
It enables us to think about healthcare in such a different way because it enables us to sort of think of it as a right and not a privilege. And it requires us to come up with solutions that affect everybody because everyone is required to participate. So that in and of itself is just like a major victory in terms of thinking. Right. So like, that's a big victory.
Well, and we're already saying like, what is it? Like something like 10 or 11 million people or something like more than, you know, than the last few, like, are now on healthcare. I mean, like, that just within the last, you know, year. I mean,
well, Krugman basically says it's better to have something than nothing, you know? We got something. And the same thing is true, you know, he even goes on to defend Dodd-Frank, which I thought was a noble pursuit of him.
I know, right?
Because you rarely hear people do that because it's not a great bill.
Right.
But he says that it sort of has a little bit more in the way of teeth than people give it credit for, and that while it won't necessarily prevent another massive, you know, anti-regulation fueled bank, you know, burnout situation, it might make lessen the blow of the next Lehman Brothers, you know, major crash.
Yeah.
And you know, he talks about in terms of environmental regulation that sort of on the sly, Obama has actually made some really lasting changes to, you know, he's provided incentives for green energy. He's created programs that have been working and have sort of increased the number of you know, green initiatives that are going on. So these are things that he has done that have not been easy to, I think, sort of like get into a soundbite. There's not like a bill with a name that we can be like, he passed this bill, the environmental regulation bill, where we all learned that, you know.
Sort of just been quietly dealing
with dealing with these things because there really hasn't been any way for him to deal with them with Congress.
Right.
But it was sort of an interesting article because Paul Krugman is not some great fan of Obama's, you know.
He's been
critical of him in the past and not from the perspective of just hating him for general reasons.
He's been critical of him for not doing
enough. For not being effective enough. And that's something that I think a lot of us on the left say, and because it's true, I think, to some degree. You know, he's been very weak in certain ways, at least in terms of his PR for what he's been doing, he's been very weak. But also he's, you know, been stuck in he's a guy who sort of doesn't have the PR game tackled, who also is in a stuck Congress. And so he's got sort of like, he's sort of like not the right guy to be in this stuck Congress with because he's not a strong enough personality to kind of power through it. So those things are all true. But I feel like, you know, in terms of how we kind of go into this next election cycle, it's maybe worth remembering that with the Democrats, we've at least gotten something.
Yeah.
With the Republicans, we've gotten nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah. With the Democrats, we got healthcare. And as much as we were supposed to hate it, we love it.
Yeah, that's right.
So there it is.
Oh, boy. This
Iowa drama
story really gets me going. So, as you know, Bruce Braley is the Democrat running for... And he's an idiot. Bless his heart. I mean, he's...
Don't even.
Don't even
bless his
heart. Well, you should, because he's trying to beat Joni Ernst, right. Who's a fucking twit.
He's so, the lesser of two evils right. In a race that is to replace an American hero, and right, that exactly. Is a problem.
Right. He's running to replace Tom Harkin, who's finally retiring. Tom Harkin has $2.37 million in his personal campaign committee account, and... Everyone from Harry Reid to basically like all important Democrats are trying to get him to give this to Bruce Braley.
Right.
He is supposedly very close with Bruce Braley. He has supposedly sort of mentored Bruce
He's
Braley.
He's thrown
this
a bunch of
thing.
Fundraisers for Bruce He's Braley. He's raised $500,000
right,
for the guy.
Exactly. But he is not giving up this cash because his intent is to give it to Drake University, which is in Des Moines, to jumpstart like this new policy institute
right.
That is going to house all of his papers. He's basically starting a presidential library.
Right.
There's already drama with the fact that he didn't give it to Iowa State.
A senatorial library, if
right,
you will.
A senatorial library. He went to Iowa State. He did not go to Drake.
Oh, interesting.
But Iowa State was not going to sort of like make it as big of a... a bigger production as he wanted.
Yeah.
It wasn't going to be as large. They weren't going to, like, give him a space to, like, house all of the papers. And, like, it was, like, a whole thing.
Yeah.
So he's, like, giving it to Drake because they're going to do it right, apparently, basically.
Yeah.
And so he's giving all $2.37 million to Drake University for his senatorial library.
Right.
And he's not giving it to Bruce Braley. And, like, all of the Democratic leadership is miffed at him, like, big time. Because that's a close race.
That's a very close race. And they...
Braley's being outspent.
Right, Braley's being outspent. This is part of the problem with the way that the Democratic sort of like, you know, bigwigs kind of deal with these campaign issues.
Sure.
Where, like, I mean, you know, they're certainly sending enough emails to us about raising funds, so I know they're strapped for cash.
Yeah.
But
I finally gave them some.
Brent, come on.
I did.
You're going to be sorry when you get even more emails.
I can't. There's no. It can't be done.
They will make it possible.
And that's sort of what
it's
I finally
possible.
Figured. They called me. It wasn't even an email. Well, I've given them money before.
That was your mistake. I've never given them money, and this is why. I don't want to get phone calls from them guilting me into giving them money later.
Yeah.
When they start talking single payer, I will start giving some money. I have some requirements.
Yeah.
But in any case.
Actually, I felt good about it.
Harkin is getting all of this grief from Harry Reid and from Michael Bennett, who's the campaign committee, the senatorial campaign committee chairman, and I think a Colorado senator, Colorado senator,
senator.
Yeah, but so Harkin's been walking around raising money at these fundraisers for this guy.
Yeah.
He's been doing his part.
Yeah,
it's not.
He's trying
enough, but it's not enough to. I mean, he shouldn't be excited about this guy. This guy's an idiot. I understand that they want to keep this seat, but like this guy doesn't really represent any sense of continuity for Tom Harkin.
I think on some level it does, in the sense that it will look bad for Tom Harkin if he does not pass the seat onto a Democrat.
Sure, but I think that will look worse for Bruce Braley than it will for Tom Harkin, because it's sort of known that he's a terrible candidate.
That's true.
You know, to for the leadership to allow this idiot to become the candidate and then be like, it's Tom Harkin's fault because he won't give up his money,
right.
Is sort of like, go fuck yourself. Put a fucking good candidate in there. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I understand why they're frustrated, but like, you know, the state Democratic Party has said that they have been satisfied with Harkin's engagement. Braley's campaign has said they've been satisfied with Harkin's participation.
Yeah, they probably have to say that.
You know, I'm sure they have to say that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying Harry Reid can go fuck himself.
Sure. Right. Well, Harry Reid is also just trying to keep his own job right now.
No, exactly.
I mean, he's not up for election, but I'm just his own job as the Senate leader.
As the Senate, yeah. No, I mean, this
majority leader.
This frustrates me because Democrats, like, to run a terrible candidate and then be like, oh, it's all these other people's fault for not giving us enough money, is sort of like, you would be able to raise a lot of money if he was a great candidate.
Yeah.
If you have a problem if Tom Harkin doesn't want to give all this money to this guy. That's a problem. And that's not his problem. It's your problem because you're running an idiot.
Yeah.
Democrats.
Yeah.
You disappoint me a lot.
But guess who was there for him?
Elizabeth
Warren. And granted, she's just sort of like making the rounds. She was up in Minnesota with Al Franken. She was in
Colorado
as well.
But you don't just go to Iowa.
But, I mean, she did two stops in Iowa. Like,
that's
just the
Iowa.
Fact that she was like on the land there. Like, on the ground. She was on the ground.
Right.
She got a taste of it.
She got a taste of it.
Makes me happy.
Seeing the sights.
Like, she's seeing the sights. She's getting familiar
she's
with
getting
things.
Familiar with
but yeah, she had a couple rallies for him. Oh my God. I forgot. Speaking of rallies, I went to a great rally yesterday.
Oh my God. Yes.
Yes.
Right, we got so distracted by our Underground Railroad discussion.
I
know.
I went to, so I was visiting my parents in Palm Desert, and of course they just moved from Yuma. So they're living in this, like, you know, this old, the retirement community, basically. Right. And the retirement community has a Democrats club. So which exciting. Is, like, very exciting for them, because they were, like, the only Democrats, like, in the entire city that they were right. living in, until that they moved from until, you know, in, like, in July. So, anyway, so they've been going to all the meetings or whatever, and there was a big rally yesterday. It was, like, their big sort of, like, you know, hoorah. They had some candidates come. They even had a statewide. They had Betty Yee come, who's, like, running for controller, or a comptroller.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, she was there. Raul Ruiz was supposed to be there, but he was, like, he was ill. I don't know about that. Right. He'd had, like, a 16-hour day before, because he'd walked in the AIDS walk. He's the guy who's running. He's their, congressperson.
Right.
Who's in, like, a very hotly contested race there. And then they had whoever's running for their state assembly person there. Somebody for the school board was there. So it was, like, a real thing. They had a good crowd. It was a wine and cheese party. They gave away some raffle prizes.
Look at that.
Everybody was real into it. It was fun seeing the, you know, the old retirees really just getting out there. Real excited.
Well, they're not busy.
No. I mean, voting is like
the most exciting. The most exciting thing that could possibly happen to a retiree.
It should be for everyone.
And it should be. It's the most exciting thing that happens to me.
Right?
I love to vote.
Take a lesson from the old farts.
I've flown to New York to vote. Back when I used to vote in New York.
Yeah.
I would sometimes plan vacations around election day so that I could vote in a voting booth because I just loved it so much.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Exciting. I know. All these people. I'm a big proponent of early voting because, like, Democrats do well when, you know,
when people can early
vote. As they kept saying at this rally yesterday, the guy who was, like, leading it was like, you know, Democrats win when, or what was it? Democrats win when everyone votes or something like that. There's some basically, like, you know, like,
if people vote, Democrats win.
Right, exactly. So, you know, I'm all for early voting, but, like, I don't personally like it because I want to go and vote.
No, exactly.
It's very exciting.
You know, in Washington State, everyone sticker. Early votes.
I want, like, the...
Everyone does paper, like, mail ballots. See, and you can, like drop it off on election day if you want. But, like, you can't go and, like, vote at a voting place.
I want to go and stand in a booth.
I want to stand in this weird line where a completely incompetent person is trying to find me on a list of a million people. And I'm not there. And I'm in the wrong district.
Upside down.
I sign your name upside down. And you get a sticker at the end. I mean, it's a great experience.
Yeah.
I do miss the days of those big voting booths where you could pull the big lever.
Yeah, I know.
Did you ever have those?
I went in with my... mother, I think,
those
a couple times
were the greatest. That, but, I only voted a couple times on those kinds of voting booths, but it was well worth it.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
Worth the wait.
Speaking of voting, though,
right? It's about to fall.
Less people in Texas are now able to do so because we talked, I'm sure, a long time ago. It was passed a couple of years ago. Yeah. I think this Texas voter ID law.
Well, in that spate of voter ID laws that got passed in every state around the presidential election, by the Republicans. Right. That's what.
So it was in the Supreme Court. It wasn't like an actual hearing in the Supreme Court because they may hear it later, I think, actually. But what they did was there was sort of like an injunction by like a district court on it that they sort of like were having to decide whether they were going to let it go forward in this, whether they were going to let Texas use the voter ID law in the upcoming election that. A lot of these like new voter ID laws have like had, you know, hearings as to whether they were like, not necessarily whether they could go forward, but whether they were going to be able to be instituted like in this new election, because these are in a lot of these states the first election where they're going to be instituted.
Right.
So it's sort of like, are we ready to do this? Like, have we given people ample time to like get their IDs?
I was gonna say,
to like
if it's a voter ID law, you have to be able to.
Because that's why
get
I think
in
Wisconsin that they decided not to do it because like people haven't had enough time to like considering the process it takes to like get the proper ID, whatever. So, but anyway, so the Texas voter ID law, they decided can go forward, and a lot of people have compared this to like, you know, a poll tax basically, because what it is if you don't have proper state issued identification, then you have to get your proper birth certificate, which costs money.
Right. There's no form of ID that's free that you can get to do
this. Exactly. So you're basically having to pay to
and
vote
wasn't
in Texas.
Was this the state where you could use a gun license but you couldn't use a school ID or something
that
like
sounds
that?
Sounds like a thing that Texas
state, and I think it was Texas, where there were like all of these things that you could use except a student ID.
Right.
You couldn't use a student ID because that's free.
Yeah. And it was also only the three women were the three that voted against it. So that means
Roberts voted for it.
Well, and Breyer,
and
too.
And Breyer voted for it.
Democrat. I mean, that is upsetting to me.
Sexism.
Like, pull it together. Right? I mean,
Seriously. Only women can sympathize with people who don't have IDs?
I guess. Like, what is that? I have no idea. But, so, it's been weird with these voting ID laws because, like, they've been sort of all over the place with them because, like, and the numbers of dissent has varied in each of the things that they've heard. But they allowed Ohio to cut early voting from 35 days to 28. But they permitted North Carolina to end same-day voter registration. But then they also, like we said, mentioned they denied Wisconsin permission to proceed with their voter ID law. So it's been sort of like kind of all over the map with like different people dissenting and like allowing some states to do other things but not allowing some states to do other things. It seems very like kind of,
and this is still wacko. In a world where I believe that we learned recently that in the last billion votes cast only 3 were fraudulent.
Well, right, exactly. Like,
this is a world that doesn't need voter ID laws.
Right, exactly.
It's not, voter fraud's not happening.
Right,
it's not
so a obviously problem. Obviously people were pissed. The, you know, Sherilyn Flynn, who's the president of the NAACP Legal Defense, she said that this was an affront to democracy. Eric Holder's office released a statement. He said it's a major step backward to let stand a law that a federal court after a lengthy trial has determined was designed to discriminate.
Well, and that's the thing, is all these laws are clearly designed to discriminate. They're not designed to address a problem because the problem doesn't exist,
right,
because there's only 3 instances of voter fraud that we can remember in history.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the only purpose of them is to discriminate. That's obvious.
Yeah.
People.
But speaking of the Supreme Court, I love this story, actually, because like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you may remember, after that Hobby Lobby sort of epic takedown, like dissent that she wrote.
She's got a little bit of a cult following.
Yeah, and there was like a Tumblr that was started that, and there was like that whole thing where everyone was calling her the notorious RBG.
Right.
So she was doing some interview, like some panel discussion or something, and the person asked her about
if she
knew about the Tumblr. And does she ever?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she knows. She said, I think a law clerk told me about this Tumblr and also explained to me what Notorious RBG was a parody on. She said, and now my grandchildren love it, and I try to keep abreast of the latest that's on Tumblr. And then they went on to ask her whether, because there's t-shirts of this with her photo on it with Notorious RBG. And they asked her if she was familiar with them or had any of them. And she says, I have quite a large supply. She's got them.
She's got,
like, sitting on these.
She's got like a box of Notorious RBG shirts.
Which is... perfection.
That's everything. That's everything
so
you want. Is she giving them to her friends? Like, what's happening? Is she starting some sort of like
team? I want to see her with one on.
Absolutely.
What the dream is.
That's the dream.
Yeah.
That's it.
Oh, boy.
And in final news, Monica Lewinsky joined Twitter.
That's it.
There
see
it
you
is.
Next week. So seriously, though.
There's no story there.
Right.
But we just thought you
everyone
should
Everyone was talking about it today.
Everyone was talking about it.
It was apparently a thing that people
cared
about.
She didn't tweet anything interesting.
No,
the only thing
sure
she's done in years is write that, what was it, a Vanity Fair article about why she cheated or whatever.
Didn't she say something I think she released some statement today or something like that she was like against cyberbullying or something like that.
Yes,
but like,
something
I mean,
like that.
She didn't, it wasn't like a
real thing.
It wasn't exciting.
No.
But she's there.
But she's on Twitter.
So follow her if you want to see if you want to
a boring person. Right. I don't know what you would want to do with her on Twitter.
Know.
But
no.
She's there. Tried to overcome the sort of anti-Monica general
she's
social media.
Yeah, back out into the world.
Yeah, she's putting herself back out in the world.
Yeah.
So, in any case, that's the news this week.
Yeah.
We will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.